Well, I'm researching horticultural science in the period 1910 to 1930, and historians of science generally in the UK have not focused on this aspect of science. Those who have written about agricultural science, such as Palladino, Vernon, Holmes, to mention a few, have not given horticultural science the same attention. Albee mentioned it in the context of a broader perspective on genetics, but for him it was a side issue rather than a real focus of inquiry. And Jem Thirsk has argued that horticulture between 1890 and 1940 underwent a revolution, but she ignored the role that science and technology played in this transformation. So currently I'm trying to identify what factors shaped and gave direction to horticultural science, and the Cambridge University Low Temperature Research Station, henceforth LTRS, because it's too long to be saying that title, is one important factor. The LTS, to put it in context, was part of a significant development in science that took place in the UK during this period, the foundation and growth of state and privately funded research stations in horticulture, agriculture and fisheries. It led to an array of investigations and experiments in laboratories, in the field, in pots, outside or undercover, and in greenhouses. And research topics included plant, there's a whole list, but just a few key ones, plant nutrition, soil fertility, rootstocks, the production of new varieties, the life cycle, control, eradication, prevention of pests and diseases, and of course, the treatment of produce to ensure longevity in storage. In fact, the case that I'm looking at now is part of a sort of a thrust to look at food, and it was jamming, dehydrating, bottling, etc. So the preservation of food was just one aspect of this research program. And other countries initiated these sort of horticultural research stations too, but obviously there were variations in scale and subject matter. Well, to return to the LTRS, what I'd like to do, if I can press that, is to try and cover the origins, very very briefly each one, the origins, the challenges, the influence, the tensions, and the conclusion, if that's okay with everybody. So the origins of the LTRS at Cambridge can be traced to the First World War. There was a concern that the German U-boat attacks would cause food shortages, and there was a realisation that not all horticultural produce reached the consumer in a safe condition because of failure, either in storage or in transport, barges, trains, ships, etc. So the Ministry of Food and the storage industry itself approached the new Department of Scientific and Industrial Research, henceforth DSIR, to ask them, you know, could you do something about this? Could you do some research into trying making trying to preserve food and keep it for longer? So that was one sort of force. Growers themselves were putting pressure as well, and they were frustrated because with a glut, they couldn't keep it. So produce used to go rotten. If there was only a method of preserving it for a bit longer, could maybe keep it when prices were higher and make a better profit. And also, the apple growers needed some device other than barn storage to try and get the apples, particularly the autumn apples, eating and cooking apples, lasting out for a longer period. So in the light of all that and other pressures, the DSIR set up the Food Investigation Board in 1917 with William Hardy as director. Hopefully, Sir William later. And the main researcher was Franklin Kidd, also joined by Cyril West. And that was the core team. Kidd initially worked on low temperatures and also combinations of oxygen and carbon dioxide to try and preserve produce for longer periods. I was making critical comparisons of the two. There was a need for a well-equipped food storage laboratory to centralise research because, strangely as it may appear, there were different outposts around Cambridge, around London, to look at different aspects of research. It wasn't all put together. And in fact, when Kidd began working in 1918 for the DSIR. He was based in the botany department at Cambridge and was hampered. He couldn't really get hold of or find initially proper refrigeration or gas storage facilities. So he was driven to use the medical school's refrigeration units. But when the course sort of picked up towards the end of the war, that was a no-no. And for gas storage, he approached the large grower, I don't mean large size, an extensive grower of acreage, John Chivers at Cambridgeshire. And he built, out of the goodness of his heart, a non-refrigerated commercial gas store so that a large-scale experiment could take place. So for those reasons and others too, the DSIR approached Cambridge University and said, is it okay, can we have a centralised research lab here? And in 1922, to cut a long story short, the LTRS was opened with Hardy. He made himself superintendent for reasons which I haven't got time to go into now. Frederick F. Blackman, reader in botany at Cambridge, was the head of the horticultural section, and Kidd and West were the main researchers. It was regarded as being special and unique at the time in its function. And the whole building was seen really as a very expensive piece of scientific apparatus. Cambridge were so excited about it, they hoped it would serve every department possible that was relevant. And they also thought it would be a device to extend the frontiers of the new sciences of biophysics and biochemistry. So there was great expectations for the station. The glass house or sun chamber on the roof promised the exciting possibility of investigating plants there that could experience Arctic conditions, and also whole fruit trees in pots to see the whole tree at work and not branches and bits and pieces, look at transpiration and so forth. So by 1926, thanks to the work of its staff, 29 staff by about 1924-25, it has secured an international reputation. But creating the LTRS was a huge technical challenge. There were long and protracted debates and discussions over a number of years before the station was open, starting in 1919, with Cambridge University, the Food Investigation Board, research staff, engineering firms, and other people. Was Cambridge the right location for this centralised station? Should existing refrigeration units be used? I mean, the favour system was by a person called Dr. Kapadia, and they favoured his system because, unlike the Lawton system, it didn't cause explosions, so it didn't have smoothies all over the place. When Dr. Kapadia was approached, he eventually declined to accept a trial of his equipment. So they decided, well, let's build a thing from scratch. And the ingenuity of the designers was severely stretched. Reliable materials and equipment had to be found to ensure the different temperatures and gas combinations were obtained, maintained, and monitored. And so, thanks to the DSIR emphasis on really teamwork and liaison with industry, Cambridge University received great scientific assistance and advice during and after the foundation of the station from the National Physical Laboratory, National Engineering Laboratory, the Forest Products Research Laboratory, the military, other universities, other horticultural research stations, refrigeration industry itself, and growers. And in 1927, the Empire Marketing Board gave funding to enable the extension, and two new wings were built, especially for horticultural produce, so that new laboratories, more up-to-date equipment, and bigger storage facilities could be made available. When it was open, Kidd and West moved in, and throughout the 20s conducted an extensive number of experiments and investigations on temperature and gas concentrations for fruit and vegetable storage. Kidd's work at Imperial College early on, in 1912-13, and at Cambridge 1914-18, he was a conscientious, he was a Quaker, so therefore he didn't fight in the war, he was doing this research as a substitute. That built up quite an extensive body of knowledge. Particularly, he was looking at carbon dioxide effects on seeds and germination and potato tubers. All that was used to help him as fruit and vegetable prolongation of life. After many careful investigations, both researchers by 1930 had produced 11, well, they produced the answer to store 11 different types of fruit in different, obviously each fruit and vegetable required a different combination, a different temperature, a different gas combination to ensure it lasted a fair amount of time in storage. And they did publish quite a lot of material. And in their published material, they were actually promoting and advocating the use, or the consideration, certainly, of in different experiments, not the same experiment, of a wide range of variables. And initially, as I said, they looked at temperature, carbon dioxide and oxygen. But later on, they decided that they were arguing that that's not good enough. The grower, as well, has to be involved. So looked at relative humidity in the storage chambers, rainfall before harvest, the soil type, the variety of veg, as I said, and also a huge range of cultural factors. By 1948, Kidd had built up a sufficient body of knowledge based on experiments to able to offer a summer school in food science, a term which he coined. Well, the work of Kidd and West is very influential. They were responsive to the needs of consumers. Banana imports was an increasing commodity. It was very popular, bananas. They helped the Trinidad scientists with problems because the bananas often arrived unfit for consumption because they were stored at a too low temperature. So they gave advice and assistance to scientists and the government and shippers in Trinidad. And in 1928, they built a low-temperature research station based on Kidd and West's ideas for banana research. Also, they helped Australian importers. That was a huge problem. Apples were imported from Australia, and it caused a financial loss of £250,000 in 1 year, the damage in transit of the apples. They suffered from a thing called brown heart disease, which was the scent of the apple. It just was dead, obviously not fit for consumption. Kidd and West got on the case, and they found out after a lot of experiments that it was too high a level of carbon dioxide. Kidd can be very difficult at times. They did make enemies, and he found it almost impossible to establish a relationship with the growers who were not familiar with technical terms. And so West went as Kidd's representative and prevented the chilly atmosphere from developing. Kidd, though, did a great big tour of Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, the States and Canada, giving advice to scientists on controlled atmosphere storage. And I think, you know, the scientists from these countries were made very welcome at the LTRS at Cambridge. And I think Kidd's desire to be a practical help and his attention to each country's or each grower's and scientist's particular problem was one set of factors which enabled these countries, the scientists, and the governments and the shippers to actually try out and investigate the ideas, experiments, and the devices that were developed at Cambridge. Biffen, Prof of Ag Botany and head of its horticultural research station at Cambridge, used the LTRS on his quest to try and find whether strength in wheat depended on winter cold. And the vitamin C studies at Lister Institute were being helped because the LTRS supplied apples which were given different treatments to find out whether, you know, vitamin C was affected by, say, freezing or gas. It was affected by gases, but freezing didn't seem to do much damage. By 1930, the Ditton Laboratory had opened, and this was a great big, huge research, low-temperature research station at East Mulling, and Kidd played a big role in its construction. There were tensions at the LTRS between pure and applied science. Hardy believed passionately that the LTRS should be a laboratory for fundamental research or pure research, and that research findings should underpin applied science. Hardy warned Kidd and other researchers at the LTRS not to get involved in applied work, because it would gravely prejudice their scientific careers and their chances of becoming fellows of a Royal Society. He didn't like patents, Hardy. He believed by the mid-20s that they should be banned because they went about the pursuit of knowledge. But despite Hardy's views, Kidd did take out several patients. The atmosphere at the station must have been fairly tense then. The DSIR wanted research to be practical use. Hardy cast doubt whether horticultural growers could actually understand what was being told by the LTRS and grow fruit under controlled conditions, so the storage life would be better. He thought his workers were a temperamental bunch, and he thought one of his managers was quite a weak disciplinarian, and another had difficulties controlling his temper, so it must have been quite a rough ride at the LTRS at some point in time. To conclude my last couple of minutes, this case study, an example from the working world of horticulture, raises many questions. At this stage of research, it would be useful to know if their methodology, Kidd and West methodology, was influenced by the pioneering work of R.A. Fisher at Rothamsted. Why was the United States slow to adopt commercial low-temperature gas storage when its horticultural scientists were quite innovative in other areas? What debates took place between the scientists and growers at the LTRS and the fields that provided them with material? And how did experiments end? What were the reasons for the termination? How did the range of the communities involved at the LTRS enable it to achieve a reputation as a credible and reliable scientific instrument? And Kidd built up a small team which included his wife. Hardy was against this. He preferred individual research. Kidd tended to make intellectual property productivity claims, whereas Hardy was inclined towards priority claims. So what impact was made on the research program as a result of these different positionings? What were the research implications of the LTRS being funded by different bodies with different agendas? How did that influence the direction of the research and the professional behaviour of the scientists there? And there's more questions, but the work that I have undertaken so far leads me to conclude that the investigations at the Cambridge LTRS and those at the other state and privately funded horticultural and agricultural research stations in the UK gave shape and direction to horticultural science in the years between 1910 and 1930.
Thank you.